Welcome to A Conversation With, an interview podcast series where we invite leaders, designers, and prominent figures in the board game space to sit at our table and take part in a conversation. Today, James Hudson takes a seat, a dreamer and a high achiever from Alabama that has transformed the relationship between publishers and content creation. We'll discuss his growth in the industry and his newest title, Bloodstone. Pull out a chair, pour yourself a drink, and join the exchange.
Hello, James.
Hello, Jesse.
Is that how we start this? Is that the... Should we just begin there?
I'm still drinking coffee, so, you know... Sure.
we can start however we want, I suppose. It'll really come down to Jan and how he edits this together. Either way, you, the audience, if you're tuning into this, you're listening to something that's a little bit different here on the Quackalo podcast. We've experimented with interviews and conversations in a variety of other formats, but normally, during these Tuesday days, you're listening to a Played It Once segment. And those will come back, but for now... And moving into the future, we're hoping to do a series every now and then of conversations with people here in the industry, with new games coming out, designers, artists, creatives, people that we admire, respect, and in my opinion, want to copy their trajectory to some degree. Today, I'm talking with James Hudson. We have a little bit of an interesting history together. You were the first publisher, first content creator, or, you know, whatever you are, to send me a title to preview. I remember being, you know, a tiny little quackalope. I had been around for about a month. I had maybe 100 or so subscribers, maybe a little bit more. And you sent me a message, something along the lines of, hey, someone didn't deliver. We have a freed up prototype and we have about 2 days to produce content on it. If I overnight this to you, are you able to put something on your channel? And being the stubborn person that I am, absolutely, because it sounded like a cool opportunity. It was the first prototype I'd ever had, and I was genuinely shocked that you were reaching out. So, for me, this conversation is an interesting one. Meeting you the first time at Origins, and then again at Gen Con, and hanging out, and the conversations that we've had, and the relationship that we've built over the past few years... It's been such an interesting journey for me to observe, and I don't know how you feel about this. You've seen a lot of people rise and grow and built relationships in this industry, but for me, you were kind of the first connection to board games industry that I had. Being said, we are we're having a conversation because you have something new coming to the marketplace, kind of like that first time you reached out to me. We've covered a few titles together at this point, and I have to say, I have played, I believe, 6 games of this at this point, and I am still enjoying them and still want to play another one. Could you give us a hello and a little bit of an introduction into Bloodstone?
Hey, y'all. James Hudson here, your resident board game redneck. it's funny. Yeah, you're right. The way we met, you know, I've always been drawn to media that uses cinematography as its base, because I did photography for a long time. I did some wedding photography. I did some family photography.
I could see you as a wedding photographer.
I didn't like it.
I could also see that.
It was a great way to make some great vacation money, you know, that sort of thing. But then, I think we're probably going to be able to understand each other here. You quickly learn that it's not a very fun extra way to make money. You've got your Saturdays are destroyed. You have a few bad events that just taint you. Like you become jaded very quickly.
So. It's the bad events that can hurt and jade people. I have to say, from my side of things, though, I never really did much on Saturdays anyway. I'm not that big of a social butterfly, and wedding photography for me, the good days, the opportunity to capture, tell a story, be there as a central conductor for a day that I have always held a great deal of respect for, really has been lovely. And so one of the cool things for me at this point is I've gotten the opportunity to turn down people to say, I don't want to be your wedding photographer. And then for people that I do, that I have a relationship with, or I've had conversations with, or even some people here in the industry, in the board game space, I've had the opportunity to reach out and say, tell me your price, or just let me know your date. I will show up and give you something that I think is valuable.
Sure. Yeah.
So it's different. If you put yourself in a position where you're able to be jaded, or you have no option to get out of those bad weddings,
sure,
absolutely.
Sure.
I like the luxury of being able to say, I can still do this and still enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, it's one of those things where, I just love the look of DSLR high-end photography. And so, you know, early on in your deal, right, when you started putting your content together,
sure,
you know, that was a big focus. And I was like, oh, sweet, somebody's using good equipment and someone knows lighting. Ah, this is great. I hope his content takes off, because this is the thing. It's not necessarily even about you, Jesse.
Sure.
Our industry desperately needs more tastemakers. We need more shut up and sit downs. We need more man versus meeples, more Sue Sheldon. We need more people that people follow and then get excited about the content and the games and the things that they're making. And because that's what, you know, if you look at video games versus us, like, you've got thousands of tastemakers. But also the volume, obviously the volume of people that are consuming that thing is much
growing
higher.
Space.
And so,
you know,
we're
small and scrappy, but I think as we get bigger, I think you're 100% right. We need more voices and more communities.
More voices, more communities. Like, I was really excited this week to see Raina. Her TikTok, she had one of her posts do like over 2 million views and get 170,000 followers in like 2 days. It's amazing. Like, that's what, because, you know, that's not all board hobbyist board gamers. That's mainstreamers. And so hopefully people are like, oh, what is this board game stuff this lady's talking about? You know, we need that. So super excited about, just in general, circling up with you, talking about projects, talking about the industry. I'm a born talker. You can ask any of my elementary teachers that used to stick my desk in the corner, facing the corner, and I would just laugh at them. Like, you think this is going to stop me from talking? I'll talk to the wall. So I love it. I love getting here talking, and especially talking about Bloodstone, because Bloodstone is my baby. It was my first board game design ever. I was a chicken and didn't want to do anything with it for quite a long time, because I had built up in my head what I wanted it to be or what I thought it could be. And so I literally found every excuse to keep delaying putting this out or moving forward faster with it. But I'm glad I did, because I feel like now, you know, we've hit this point where our designs are better, our develop process is better. So the game's better and our storytelling's better. And, you know, now that the resources are in place around me here at Skybound, you know, I feel like this is going to be the best version of Bloodstone it could ever be. So now I'm ready. Now I'm ready to, like, let's show everybody this thing. So
I'm really excited about Bloodstone, but I'm also excited to have a conversation with you about the space, your journey, and what it's taken to get to this point.
Sure.
So could you give me a quick overview or a quick rundown of what Bloodstone is for the audience that's kind of listening, so they have a sense of what this new title is? And then let's take the journey in that direction. Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk a little bit about your history, how you got to the position you're at currently at Skybound, some of the other games that have popped up over your career. And at the end, we'll dig a little bit deeper and dive farther into Bloodstone, the design choices there, and some of the things you're doing in this board game, or at least in this publishing space, that haven't been done, I don't believe, anywhere else in the industry.
Sure, sure. So, all right, so let's start at the beginning. All right, I was born on September 30th.
No. Start with a quick overview of Bloodstone. Give us the framework.
So, at its core, Bloodstone is an arena combat game that you can either play against your friends or play with your friends. So, it has two main modes of play. I use a lot of video game terms when I talk about Bloodstone, because it is heavily inspired by my video game past with Blizzard specifically. I'm a big Blizzard fanboy with Warcraft and Diablo and Starcraft. You're going to PvP or you're going to PvE, or co-op or competitive. And, you know, you're in the arena. It's gladiator style combat with asymmetric abilities, asymmetric players, a crazy dice system that allows you to take your asymmetric dice and put them in other people's hands, which typically playtesters and players find that to be one of the cooler things about the game. And then when you face off against the monsters, the bosses, it's like you've stepped into a raid boss situation in Warcraft, where you've got a closed environment that has multiple things happening, and you and your teammates have to figure out the puzzle and try to defeat the puzzle as a team. And just at its core, that's really what the game is in those two buckets. And then, you know, you sprinkle in a lot of video game type stuff with unlocking content, upgrading your character, things like that. So, you know, one of the things that I keep seeing from all the content creators that I'm getting to play with, getting to play the game with over the last few weeks as we ramp up for the launch, is they just the word fun. They're like, everything that you're describing, everything that I'm experiencing as I'm playing, and you're showing me that this gets unlocked, and now I get access to this, and now I get to do this. They're just like, it's just fun. You know, I don't think there's anything necessarily groundbreaking design wise, right? We don't have the next Dominion here on our hands, but it's just incredibly fun and enjoyable.
Yeah, I would be able to attest to that. We have two recorded gameplays of the cooperative mode right now with Alex from Board Game Co. and I going head to head against your two prototype creatures. And the amount of moments that happened in that sequence, highs and lows across those gameplays are pretty ridiculous. Yeah, that's all I'm going to say. So now let's start with where and when you were born. Let's begin there.
Let's don't do that. but no, seriously, you know, I lived in Alabama my whole life up till 2 years ago. And I had 11-year career in marketing. It was in a much different industry. It was in the trucking and construction industries. I worked for a company that that's a whole different world over there. But like the trucking industry, they don't have enough people to drive trucks to move all this freight that needs to be in our country, because we have this huge country, right? And stuff comes in on all the coasts, and it's got to get all over the place. And truckers have to carry it. And none of these companies could be making millions and millions and millions of more dollars if they could move more of this freight.
If they only had drivers.
And so I worked at a place to help them hire drivers and do marketing. And I really loved it. You know, I mean, I really did love marketing, because it's its own way of a creative outlet, right? You know, helping a company tell a story about their culture. And I enjoyed that and made really good money, but it was very corporate America, right? It was very, you're supposed to have 35% growth the quarter, and right now you're at 23% growth. So can you tell us how you're going to get the other 12% growth? And you're just like,
And all you have is an artistic thing to hand over. And you're like, well, this flyer is red. There's a good chance that'll increase it by 2%.
It's one of those things where you feel like it doesn't feel like you ever do enough, right? Like, it was like, I just made you a bunch more money the last 2 months, and you're asking me how I can make you more money. And it's like, it just never stopped. And
for sure.
It was weird. I was back in the day, I was just playing Warcraft with some friends. I had some local friends that we all raided together. And one night they said, we're getting together to play board games. Do you want to come over? And I was like, I absolutely do not want to play Monopoly or Scrabble with you. No, thank you. And they were like, they laughed and they're like, we don't play Monopoly. You're in luck. And I was like, okay, whatever. I like y'all, so I'll just come hang out with you when you play your stupid board games. And we played Power Grid. And I fell in love, and I was like, what the hell is this? This is amazing. And, you know, I did the thing that we all do. I went to Barnes & Noble. I went to Target, bought,
came home with 25 games.
Yep. Made Sandra play a game with me. She's like, she had the same reaction of board games.
forced your wife to play a game. Mm-hmm. And then usually, to be fair, usually that's probably the wrong game to have introduced her to, if I'm making an assumption there. I tried to teach so many people how to play Kingdom Death when I first got into the hobby. Almost 80% of them never should have touched that game.
No. Yeah. I went down the rabbit hole really quick. Before I knew it, we were going to Gen Con with a group that we drove a car up, four of us in the car. When we came back, like, we had packed every cubic volume square inch of that car with board games on the way back, because we bought everything. We just bought it all. So it was great, you know. And then I watching, and I don't need to necessarily get in, but actually Bloodstone was my first game design. And so
which is crazy.
As I'm always being a creative, I've always, like I said, did photography, did some art, things like that. I've always liked making things and making content. And so, you know, started dabbing with ideas. I got inspired watching Titan's Grave. It was Will Wheaton had this show on Geek and Sundry. It was his RPG that he and his son wrote, and they used the AGE or the Age system from Green Ronin Games, where they have these, you roll 3d6 and it has the stunt system tied into it. I loved it. I still go back and watch that series. It's only like 10 episodes. I love it. He had hired voice actors to play the character, so like, it's so good. And you know, you just get into that and you're like, I'm inspired. I think that dice rolling system would make a really cool combat system for a tabletop game. And obviously it's nothing really necessarily like the stunt system for that, but it was definitely inspired by it. So I owe Chris Pramus probably a dollar.
At least
a hug and a handshake and a steak dinner. But that's what you want as a creative. If anything that I make inspires anybody else to make something, that's like one of the greatest compliments ever. And so, yeah, well, started dabbing around with a dumb idea that I thought would be fun. Quickly found out that I definitely wanted, I always have high hopes, you know, high inspiration. I'm probably just naive as well to think that I can pull something like this off.
Yeah. Usually those that are blindly ambitious with a lot of hope and love for the world tend to also be a little bit naive.
I was definitely naive. You know, I was like, oh, I'm going to totally make this like a CMON game, you know, because at the time I was, you know, I was totally into Blood Rage, things like that. Right. So I was like, this is what I want to make. I want to make that. But I did at least realize that I did not at the time have the resources to pull that off. And so I started I had another idea for a family card game, and that's where Barnyard Roundup came from. In 2016, we launched that on Kickstarter, and that was the first foray into the industry to try to learn what is this board game publishing thing and how does it work. And I quickly found out that A, I loved it, but B, holy hell, is it hard.
You've had an interesting journey, because from first discovering board games, bringing a few home to play with the wife, then both of you falling in love with the hobby and starting to explore this space more and more, you initially started and kind of launched your career on two platforms, building out a social media following and then pairing that with a successful Kickstarter launch. That launched Druid City Games, correct? Am I correct on the timeline there?
Yeah. About a yearish before we launched Barnyard, I made the board game Spotlight, and it was two things. I wanted a community that was the opposite. It was positive. You know, so often you'll see, and you still see it. Obviously, the world's quite a different place than it was 5 years ago. The rhetoric has really ramped up, but you know, 5 years ago, for sure, it was just mostly, you'd have people poo-pooing on other people's joys. You know, somebody would be like, man, I love this game. We had tons of posts, right? Of like, I love this game. And then five comments under that is people going,
That game sucks.
You suck.
Anyone that likes that game's an idiot.
Yep. It's tons of gatekeeping, tons of just negativity. And, you know, I quickly wanted to carve out a space that was like, none of that's allowed here. You know, and if you can't say anything nice, then you don't have to be a part. So then we quickly became labeled as the Care Bears.
I'm all right with that term.
We embrace, baby. Come on.
Sure.
Like, you couldn't have branded us any better, which is why we kind of leaned into that. So, and we're fine that our group and our community doesn't grow to some of the sizes of some of the others because it's highly curated. You know, we're going to continue to lean into kindness and diversity and inclusion. And, you know, just shut your mouth if you don't have anything nice to say. And that we don't always get it right. I don't always get it right. Sometimes I have sure. I have opinions. Yeah. So, but yeah, that was, you're right. I started there.
I think that's one of the, in curating a group that is allowed and able to be positive, I think that's one of the things that people overlook is for me, one of the first starts of curating a community is recognizing that I'm going to mess up. Because it then extends that same degree of grace onto other people. It gives them permission as well to mess up and not to necessarily not be corrected or have a conversation about mistakes that are made, but just recognizing that you're creating a group that is about bringing people together, you know, creating a diverse and friendly space.
Well, I mean,
people are going to make mistakes.
Yes, the thing is, like, when it comes to creating a community, if you've carved out what the, you know, ethos of that group is, then it's easy to curate and say,
for sure,
this is what we're about. And so if you're not about this, then this is not the group for you, right? Like, there's nothing wrong with saying that this, you know, you shouldn't be a part of this group, because here's our core competency, right? It's the groups that say we are everything to everybody. That doesn't exist now. We are all, especially in echo chambers, with the way the last 4 years have went, in one way or the other. And I think it's okay to just say, you know what, I need this out of this space, or I need this out of that space. And you can join different groups and different communities that have different purposes.
Yeah. The internet's made it hard to have conversations. And one thing that we, in terms of the communities that we're fostering, is advocating for, the realization that conversation is the only place, like one-on-one conversations is the only place where understanding and compassion and change actually comes from. Mm-hmm. And all that being said, so you launched the Board Game Spotlight as a bright light in this industry. And then about a year after that, you were saying on your timeline, you put up your first Kickstarter game.
Yeah.
And since then, you've launched quite a few more, a few through Druid City, and then you transferred over to Skybound. What have been some of the highs and lows of that journey so far? What has it been like going from a indie publisher to someone who's now a figure and a recognizable one in our space?
I'm laughing because when you say lows, like, those are the ones that pop into your head right away.
Sure,
like,
of course. You already knew seven of those. The highs is the hard question.
Oh man, there's so many highs and lows. You know, lows are easy because running a business is very hard. Running a board game business is very hard, because the margins just aren't there. Like, it is that, you know, no one is driving Lambos in the board game industry. You know what I'm saying?
I've got a 2008 Kia Rio. It's the only car I've ever owned, you know. It has 235,000 miles on it.
Just, I'm not even talking about you, Jesse.
As far as my trajectory is going, I hope it lasts for another 5 years.
But go look at even the super, you know, I'm air quoting right now, the super successful publishers. Like, nobody has a mansion.
No one is.
Nobody's driving Lambos. This isn't video game money, right? Like, margins aren't huge. So, fetal position. That's where you end up a lot of times, when you launch projects and you take big risks, and, you know, some would say, well, don't take risk. Well, then you probably didn't make any games that made any waves either. So you've got to try things, you've got to do things, and, you make plays, you make bets, and sometimes they pay off and sometimes they don't. And, you know, overall though, it's been an incredibly positive, thing for me and for the people that are hopefully around me. And I've definitely screwed that up a couple times. And you know what? Those will be the things that I regret. I'll take to my grave regretting the people that I have either crossed or I didn't do as well by them as I possibly could have. You know, I think back on, like, certain people that maybe our interaction could have been better. I could have done better by them. And those are the things that for me, I'll take to the grave regretting. But yeah, overall, man, it's just been a great, you meet so many great people in this industry, you know, and there's so many good people with good hearts, and we're all similarly like-minded, trying to do some of the, you know, just build community, play board games.
Jan had a quote that I really like, and I'm figuring out a way to incorporate it into my language, but it was something along the lines of, we enjoy board games because we're together.
Mm-hmm.
Just that emphasis, just taking away anything else, like the whole core reason is just because we get to be across the table from each other. So let's go through some of the titles that you've launched.
Sure.
What are some of the, when it comes to some of the like moments that you remember, big bright lights in the sky, what do some of these titles represent to you?
Yeah, it's a nice mix. So Barnyard Roundup, the first game was like, I have no idea what's going to happen. Are people going to be interested in this? You launch it, you get funded, and you're like, sweet, I get to make a thing. My name is on a box. That there's something about that, right? That first time your name's on the box, even though only like, you know, 600 people have the game. It's like, that doesn't matter, right? But then like we also did Guardians Call after that because I was like, oh, well, this, or no, I'm sorry. We did Grim Forest after that. So you did Grim Forest. It's a big success, you know, in the terms of comparatively, right? Like $400,000 and change versus $17,000 situation. Then we did
one of my first introductory games.
Nice. Yeah, yeah.
When I jumped into, I mean, Catan and Ticket to Ride and Family Games were there right ahead of the curve, but sure. When I first started playing board games at Labyrinth Games and Puzzles, going to their Thursday night meetups, I believe the very first night I was there, I played The Grizzled and The Grim Forest, nice. Which then came home with me and were some of the very first pieces of content I covered on Quackalope.
And that was, you know, one of the things that we really wanted to ramp up the toy factor of Grim Forest and its table presence. And
I still need to do a painting video where I get those pigs all shiny.
Yeah, for sure. And they're easy to paint because they have big features.
Oh, they're so cute.
Those big features make it easy to paint. So,
yeah.
It's been great to watch people, as I call it, bedazzle that game. You know, there's tons of like really deluxified people who've been able to take that game and really blow it up. It, you know, it was great. It was awesome. I love seeing people get excited about that. And, you know, our mission from the beginning, even with Grim Forest, was to make it a diverse experience. So, like, you look at all the characters that we built into that game and their makeup. Like our one story that I'll always remember is I'm cruising through Facebook doing my social media stuff. There's a post in a Chinese board gaming group and it's our Snow White because we had turned the character into an Asian character. Because even when you read the description of Snow White in the book, you're like, I could see that being of Asian descent. And, I was like, oh no, what are they saying? There was like tons of comments. So I started like, you know, it'll do like see translation. So I'm like individually clicking all these. And it was just a group of people that were so excited. And they were literally saying things like, oh, look, there's someone who looks like us in this game.
You can see yourself in it.
I can see our, yeah. And it was just different comments like that. And it was amazing. It was great. And that was like what solidified me to go like, we made the right choice. This is what we should have done. And this is what board games should strive to do is try to include people and let people see themselves. But yeah, so we did all, we went down that road, did that. And then next up was Guardians Call. And man, I thought, wow, here it is. We've arrived. Grim Forest was a huge hit. This is all we got to do is make great looking games with cool mechanics. And we're just going to keep going, baby. Woo, to the moon. And then Guardians Call did not do very well. And, you know, it's one of those things that you take in bets, learning things, trying things, and you learn, okay, well, that was a punch in the gut. So,
sure,
you know, that's not how it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be just pump out whatever. And it's going to, we're going to go to the moon. So it was a good wake up call. After that was Sorcerer City. And, you know, all these games have really fun stories to them, too. Like, you know, meeting Scott Caputo at a Gen Con. He shows me this prototype of a tile laying deck builder. And I'm like, say that again, sir. You know, and he shows it to me. And I'm like, I have to sign this game. I want it. And he was like, well, I mean, and if you've ever met Scott Caputo, he's like the most soft hearted, soft spoken man. He's like, well, I mean, I've actually. I've got like five other publishers that are very interested in this game as well. And I was like, I don't care, Scott. This is my game. and luckily he agreed. And so anyway, you know, that's been the process. You know, you find games that you're excited about. We launched them, met with I wanted to make a Wonderland game with Manny for a long time. Talked about that. Wanted to make some other games with Tim and Ben Eisner. And we jived on that for a long time. And then finally, sitting down with Mr. Cuddington, and I was pitching them this game idea. I was like, we want to make this game, blah, blah, blah. It's in this world. And David and Lena were just like, we want to do less assignment work. We're storytellers. We want to make our own worlds. And I was like, okay, I've got
sold.
So,
and for the audience that isn't aware, because you did actually, you know, teach me this as well. Mr. Cuddington is the artistic name of a husband and wife duo. Mm-hmm, is that correct? Mm-hmm. Who are just so good at what they do.
Yeah, they're extremely talented. Like, and when people start rattling off artists in board gaming that are some of their favorite, usually Mr. Cuddington's going to hit that top five of most people, right? You got the Ian O'Toole's, you got the Dutraits, right? The Mikos, and you got Mr. Cuddington, and that's their moniker, but it's David and Lena. It's a husband wife duo that live in Canada, and great humans, great people. Now that I've worked with them hand in hand for years now, at this point, I mean, they did the art for Barnyard Roundup, they did the art for Grim Forest, they did half the art for Guardian's Call. So you know, they've done a lot of stuff with Roxley. They're great humans and extremely talented. If they wanted to do art in other mediums, like, they're talented enough that, like, Disney would hire them. They'd be somewhere else if they wanted to. But they like living in their small little town in Nowhereville, Canada. So that's, you know, works out for everybody. But
it sounds really nice to me.
It does some days. You know, I'm sitting there and I'm chatting with them about this game that I want to make. And they're like, they tell me this whole thing. They want to make worlds. And I'm like, well, what if I gave you two games and you come up with the theme? You build the world, you make the theme, the whole kabang, the whole shoot. I mean, I trusted them because they're incredibly talented. So whatever they came up with, I just said, I have veto power just in case you come up with something really weird that I don't think is going to be successful. And they agree. They're like, well, we trust you to know what can sell. So sure. Of course, the first thing they showed me was this aquatic world. And they're like, we've got a world, it's Tidal Blades, essentially. Like, these people are going to be Tidal Bladers. And I was like, I don't know what a Tidal Blader is, but this looks incredible. And the answer is yes. So the rest is history, as they say, as we've churned through Tidal Blades.
Tidal Blades was like a present to me because the art book, the lore, the world building. I mean, I think I spent a good 10 or 12 minutes of the unboxing video just reading flavor text and lore. I did so, I believe, in the gameplay as well. And then afterwards, I just sat down and skimmed my way through it. So I knew every single artifact and region and environment. And it ties you so much deeper to the game and what you're experiencing. And some people don't care about story or flavor text at all.
And
those people are wrong.
I say that's fine. You say they're wrong. No, yeah, there's definitely, and I always equate this to, like, when you were playing an RPG video game back in the day. Like, did you read the story, or did you just click the buttons as fast as you could to get to the fighting?
I spent so long not completing those video games because I wanted to pause and read every piece of text in them. There's some times where I wouldn't leave the starting zone for a couple hours because
sure.
because they just had 12 books and every book had 13 pages and you just sit there forever on your little, you know, those tiny little square box computer screens. I mean, you know, we both had one of those. I was a little younger when I had one, but I would lean up close to that screen and just sit there trying to see the pixelated text and understand it. And then I somehow met Jan and Alex, who don't seem to care about story at all, which is, again, I'll reiterate, wrong.
Well, the thing is, right, and I think you'll wholly agree with me, the story's got to be good. It's got
to
be a good story because, you know, if the theme is thinly veiled, like, especially people who appreciate a good story see through that instantly. And so, you know, that's always been something I've enjoyed. You know, I think Blizzard, going back to my Blizzard fanboy days, that's one of the things that they've always, that's been at the crux of all their games, is really, really good storytelling. And, you know, you get into that and you're like, well, I want to do that. It's really hard. Good storytelling is not easy. I'm luckily at this point, I'm surrounded by, like, Ben Kepner on our team, Dan Stong. They're also incredible actors, voice actors, writers, and having those talents around you just make everything a little bit easier. But funny story. So, like, we're getting into Tidal Blades. We're getting ready to launch. The story wasn't as deep as what you have now when we were getting ready to launch. We had the game. It was pretty. there was tons of awesome stuff. And David and Lena had, you know, to me and the Eisners had really laid out a lot of like, here's the world, here's how it works, here's why they're fighting. But we hadn't really written a lot of that down. It was mostly just all floating around our head. A couple days before the campaign, I was like, what if every day we gave backers some story and we took them along a journey? And I tried to write I wrote the first days, and as an example, like a launch to the story, right? I gave it to them, both sets, both groups, the Cuddingtons and the Eisners. They instantly were like, we love this idea. Hey, James, this writing though, do you mind if we take a crack at it?
Can we have a hard conversation with you?
And I was like, totally, guys. That was there for an example. I know I have a fifth grade reading level. I'm a product of Alabama. We're 49th in education. State motto is thank God for Mississippi. So yes, please rewrite my hot dog water and let's go. And it was, we didn't really know what we were stepping off into, you know, because it turns out the Eisners are exceptional writers as well. And actually Ben Eisner had come down to LA and did some playwriting for a while. So you learn these crazy things about people as you work together. And the rest is, again, as they say, is history. We banged out 24 days worth of narrative and that turned into what is now the art and lore book of Tidal Blades. And now, because everyone ended up enjoying the story that was built around in the world so much, like that's the main driving force of the second game. You know, it's more of an adventure dungeon crawl game where we're going to unpack the story arc, right?
So, which I'm not excited about at all. I mean, clearly there's just no way I would be intrigued by anything like that.
God, it's so good. It's so good. When David and Lena sent me the story beats for the second game and like where the narrative's going, right? Like where it's going to end. I was almost in tears. Like it's so, and this is just not even like fully written out, right? It's just the highlights, just the, hey, here's where we're taking it.
I feel like I've been on a journey with you over the last year with watching the like cell phone videos and things of you and your kids playing games and just how much, you know, but you really do. I mean, you really do care and empathize and invest in your family and this community.
I'm an ENFP if you're into the Myers-Briggs breakdown. So, you know, that's just, I've learned to embrace it. You know, growing up in Alabama, you know, toxic masculinity was a thing for sure. And you're like, don't show people that you cry. But I've just embraced it over the last, 10 years, and it's who I am. And it's okay to have emotions. Those are good to have. Those are fine. And it's one of my goals is to show that to my kids, especially to my son, that, you don't have to be some hard piece of metal. There's times that you need to be hard. Sometimes you have to be. But most times it's okay just if you're sad to cry. Like there's nothing wrong with that. So it was amazing to see all these talent. A lot of times I think I attribute a lot of my success to just surrounding myself with smart and talented people and shutting up and getting out of their way.
It's a good theory. So this is a good bridge over to Bloodstone.
Okay.
I want to talk about where the design started, but since we're talking so much about story, could you give me a narrative preview of what's going on with this game?
Boy, can I.
Yeah.
And as I've been teaching content creators Bloodstone over the last couple of weeks, as we get ready to ramp up, like I tell them, I'm like, just raise your hand if I'm boring you. I'm going to dive off into the narrative and I'm going to turn into a total nerd. But it's my favorite part of introducing the game. And so gladly, what's happening here in Bloodstone? Great, great. So, Venera, let's start with Venera. She's the antagonist. She currently has the Bloodstone, in the city of Stormwrath, in the world of Avunkoth. You've got this kingdom essentially, and it has, a king and queen like some of these old school fantasy places do. But Venera was a high priestess and she had served the kingdom for a very long time. And something happened and you'll find out through the narrative of what happened. But essentially the Bloodstone was drew her and, she pulled off a coup and had the king killed and took over. Took the Braden Guard, which is the army of Stormwrath, and went to the monastery where the Bloodstone was being protected, because in this world, in Avunkath, everyone knows that the Bloodstone is a destructive force that needs to be contained. And, you know, she raised the temple and took it. And the Bloodstone has tons of magical powers, one of being the power to transform things and to resurrect things. And so she now has captured some of Avunkath's most elite champions and keeps them in her arena as a power play. It is just a, like, how could you possibly stand against me? I have your most powerful champions, and they fight to the death. And then I raise them from the dead at my whim. Like, how could you dare oppose me? And so that kind of sets the scene. It's a real thinly veiled scene setting, because I could really talk for 30 minutes. But one of the things that we're going to be doing during our campaign is a lot of people don't know this, or at least I don't. You know, maybe you haven't heard this yet. We're doing a novel. We're actually writing a book that's going to launch with the board game.
No. You're not. Listen, audience. James, you're not writing a novel to go with a game. You're writing a novel.
Yeah,
no, and
sure.
Not you. Like, a legitimate author.
Definitely not me.
You know, I'd read your novel, you know, yeah, you out of respect and compassion. Yeah. I'd read some of it.
You'd read the
I'd read a few words of it. I'd get into it. Here's the thing. When most people hear you're writing a novel to pair with a board game, mm-hmm. they think, well, one of those two is going to be not as focused or valuable or invested in
one's
as the other.
One's the lead, one's not.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're writing like a go-on-store-shelves novel.
Yeah, this is signed with Simon & Schuster. This is one of the reasons why I came to Skybound, right, is they have these other departments that have these mediums in there that I only have to walk across the hall and say, hey, Rick, how do I get Tidal Blades on Crunchyroll? Hey, Mike, how do we write a book about Tidal Blades or Bloodstone? And so this is some of that, right? And so instantly, this group that does books sets to work, and they're like, cool, well, we have a partnership with Simon & Schuster, so this is a signed thing. We have a budget to go out and hire an author. So Ari Marmel comes on board, who's a huge D&D RPG nerd, which was a perfect fit to help us build
Absolutely.
This world out. I've told this story a time or two. It's pretty funny. So we decided to do this. Sit down with Ari. Ari's like, okay, give me the rundown. Tell me about the world. Tell me where the story's going so that I can kind of dive in and start helping you flesh everything out. And I'm like, he's like, hit me with it. We schedule like 2 hours of a call, right? And after about 8 minutes, I'm done talking about the world that I've built in my head. And he goes,
wow.
Oh, that's it? That's all? You're done? And he's like, you haven't built out anything. He's like, what about currency? What about history? Yeah. What about social economic things? What about, you know, and he's just like, da-da-da-da-da-da. And I was like, oh no. So our first order of business was building a world Bible. It ended up being about a 50-page document.
But it shows the difference between what, for me, there's a lot of games that are really great that don't have depth to sure. the world building or design. And sometimes that's fine. Sometimes you don't need that depth.
Yeah.
But oftentimes the games that I love the most are games that feel like they have history or a script that is informing degrees of them. I can think of PAX Premier that is so tied to the history of the region and was designed by someone who is sensitive and a scholar of that area. I can think of Root, which maybe doesn't have a lot of depth on its own, although I do know the art design and the creativity behind it did. And I always attribute it to Mossflower and Redwall, and that gives it depth in its own space. And for me, I think that dichotomy is so fascinating. The idea of being able to talk for 8 minutes and thinking on most board games, that would be a decent amount of flavor text.
Yeah, for sure.
It's not a world, though. It's not a book.
It's definitely not a book. You know, it doesn't speak to characters' agendas and their motives, you know? And so you have to have that for a book to make it interesting. But then what we found is, as we went through this process and made this world Bible and started the first chapters of the book and where it was going, it instantly found its influence on our design, right? Because we were like, oh, well, this character, now that we've went through this process, like, this character wouldn't operate this way. So we need to rework their abilities to be more like this. And so now the two things 100% intertwine and mesh. And I feel like that's what makes a cohesive thing, right? So that now it's not the book or the game leading. They're both charging ahead parallel.
The deeper you dive into the book, the more you're going to be informed upon the decisions and little bits of art design and flavor text and scripting that's been in. It's why I say that knowing your world, establishing that flavor text early on and developing it alongside the mechanics for me is such an important element of game design, because if the very first thing I, as a thematic player, will pick up on is game design or game mechanic choices that do not or seem to break the immersion or the theme or the story of the game, I think it's one of the reasons genuinely why I've had such a good time playing Bloodstone.
Sure.
Not only is it a dice chucker, not only does it give you powerful moments and abilities and scales, which this is interesting. Alex and I have a full review coming out, and Alex doesn't care about story or theme at all, and I care way too much. I could forgive a lot of mechanic decisions, and Alex probably wouldn't or won't.
Right.
And both of us fully have enjoyed and wanted to continue playing Bloodstone. And that dichotomy, like that idea of having people that value two very separate things still enjoying and seeing the merging of those two come together is really cool.
You know, one of the things I hope the players of Bloodstone get, right, is you've got a lot of different things that I think you could enjoy about the game. If you really like the story, the art, the lore, the narrative, I think it's got that. I think it's got that more so than maybe any other board game attempt, right?
Like, I can still very much visualize that Berbalist bear charging into the arena and sucking life out of us.
Yeah, the Terror of the Everwood will mess you up. That is a raging, angry bear. But what I hope, and it kind of sounds like you're kind of leaning into this with so far with your six play sessions, is that the experience is, like, I keep saying that over and over and over to the team. I'm like, I know we're making cool mechanics. I know this thing does what it's supposed to do. I know it's got the components. It's got the production values. But at the end, when somebody's done with the, and I use campaign lightly because it's not campaign in a way that's like other campaigns, right? Like, this is campaign light. It's campaign mode. Experience.
And for the audience, what you're talking about there is you have a PvP and then a PvE session. You have a players versus players, get into this combat arena, play with, how many numbers does it go up to? How many people could you include?
You can play all eight champions at the same time on PvP. It's pure chaos.
Yes, but it sounds interesting. I'm not sure if I would love eight. I'm very intrigued to see, because the amount of just negotiating and just pure, like, bombs going off everywhere would be insane.
Yeah.
That being said, so you can play player versus player anywhere from two all the way up to eight.
That's it.
Which is one of the things that I think is interesting about this title is it's an arena combat game that scales in a really nice way. One of the things that I've compared it to, or one of the things that I've referenced to a lot of people, is you take the best parts of Dice Thrones, the dice chucking, the rolling, you stick it into a tactical arena space with new items and mechanics and systems that can be put out. And for me, it does that combat system, that showdown, that scale, escalation of powers, abilities, and more dice that you're chucking onto the table better. That's my stance. So you can play player versus player, but then you can also play player versus environment. So let's say we sat down with three or four people. We just got done with a hectic match where we were, you know, someone just slit someone's throat, you know, shot an arrow through their heart, and the other person got incinerated.
Yeah.
And now, like your narrative says, you all get, you know, stitched back together through the power of the Bloodstone, and then a creature or a beast, to continue the entertainment value of the arena, gets pulled into this stage, and you're now working together to take down this, you know, character. And it's as simple as a new deck of action cards and flipping your board over to the other side. Mechanics are fairly similar. There's a little bit of change when it comes to the wording, so that you're not targeting other players. Instead, you're targeting or influencing or supporting what they're able to do. And then this is where the campaign starts to come into play. As you take down creature after creature, you're going to be unlocking new special arena items that introduce from a spinning wheel of flame to a giant piston or a big bucket of rusty weapons that allow you to power up if you get next to it. You're going to be unlocking new character abilities and hero cards, and you're also going to be opening the floor for new ways to play the player versus player system.
Yeah.
That's the campaign you're touching on.
Yeah. It's more like a gauntlet of raid bosses, really. You know, there's no trash. There's no heavy XP system. There's not a lot of, you know, there. You read a page of text about this next creature, you set it up, and you go for it, you know, and you either kill it and take it down, or it takes you down, and then you have to reset and start over. And as you go through these bosses, you know, they're going to increase in difficulty and depth and strategy needed to beat them. And it's a, you know, overall it's an 8 boss gauntlet. And the last one in true video game form is going to be a final boss to remember. So, you know, that's it. The thing the game does.
Is it a snail?
It is a huge snail.
confirmed here.
It's a game that gives you stand-up moments, you know?
Yeah.
And I've seen that through playtest. This isn't just me trying to sell it. It's, I knew I had something when I was playing this, like, original design way back 5 years ago at the Friendly Local Gaming Store. We're playing it in the middle of a bunch of people playing Magic the Gathering, and some folks that stop playing Magic, and they come over and they're like, what is this? What are y'all playing? Can we try it? And I'm like, oh, sure, I guess, if you want. And they sit down, they play, and they're yelling at each other, and they're standing up chunking the dice. And I'm like, oh, wow, this is like, I didn't have to ask them if they liked it. I could see that they liked it. And that's what the game does. It has those moments of like, if you're like, you've got this big hand of dice, you're like, if this thing happens, I'm going to knock out both of you and I'm going to win. If it doesn't, I'm probably out, you know, and those moments are fun when you've built strategically to get there. So
I had a PvP session against 4 players at the table. And we had a moment where we all teamed up to take down Alex, who was currently probably 100 health above us. Got everyone down to that, but, you know, below 50 level. So I charged my bow with Sinrig and ended up shooting an arrow through everyone.
Yeah, pure
and
shot.
Wiping out the entire arena.
Nice.
It was great.
Yeah, Sinrig. I love a good archer. It has those moments, right? And that hopefully what it has, and at least it does for me, it has that moment of like, I can't believe you did that. Let's reset everything and let's do it again, you know? And that's the fun of board games, you know? And I hope at the end, once people say, because this is not a cheap game, this is going to be a very, you know, it's a very expensive game because there's super high production values. We didn't really cut any corners here. It's definitely the most expensive game we've ever made. But you go at the end of it, experience-wise, this campaign mode, all this unlocking of content, all these PvP moments, I have stories to tell about with my game group years from now. We'll say, you remember that time that we were fighting that boss and we needed the perfect roll to win and you pulled it off or whatever, right? It's just, that's what I think the game does well. And you know, I want to brag about mechanics and things like that because I have a lot of pride in what we've put into some of those fun ideas. But overall, I just really hope people have that experience.
So in the design process of this, what has been, in your opinion, because like you said, this has sort of been a journey over the past few years, and this is kind of your baby. It was the first design that you ever came up with, and you've been putting it off for a long time. What has been the hardest decision you've had to make around the finished product of this? What are some of the things you left on the cutting room floor that just didn't make it in?
Nothing.
Really?
It's why it's so expensive. No, really. Like we didn't take anything out. We haven't cut anything based on price. And when the quote came in, there was some extreme sticker shock. And so the decision, like the hard decision was, will people want to pay what this has to be priced at to justify?
Maybe I should reword my question a little bit. you haven't pulled any bars when it comes to what you've decided to include.
Sure.
But in the design and creation process, from the very first conception of it, the what it is now isn't what that first sketch or that first prototype was. No. Is there anything in that process that you wanted to hold on to, or that
for sure.
that was hard for you to, you know, because one of the things that I have a degree in, I have a partial degree in English and a full degree in film and media studies. And one of the first things they teach us is cut your darlings. The thing you fall in love with is probably the first thing you should remove when you continue working on a project and reiterating on it.
Sure.
Are there any darlings that didn't make it in, or did you end up figuring out how to include them?
No. So one of the big things that the initial design, since you've played it, you'll know what I'm speaking to.
I have. Yeah.
So now that you've played it, you know, each character essentially has three to four main abilities. You got your singles, your doubles, your triples. And
that's based off of how many matching sets of dice you're able to successfully roll.
Exactly. And so in the beginning, the way this worked was everyone had six abilities. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And those three dice, one of them was a special color. And so when you would roll doubles or triples, your special dice color was what determined on your menu what you had access to. So it was a little different, right?
But more complicated.
It was way more complicated. And those Magic players loved it because you had all these options. So now you have eight characters with six abilities, and you've got all these options, and it was too much.
Yeah. Even thinking through putting that step in between, I can see why it would be really cool. But for a game that plays quick and easy and is accessible, once you've rolled doubles a few times or read your suit power, you're just looking for that dice result and you already know what you're going to trigger and do instead of checking the dice result, checking the color, checking the sequence.
Yeah.
I can see that.
Yeah.
I can see how that's really cool, though, but I also can see why it didn't make the cut.
Yeah, well, it was one of those things that, like, it was there for a very long time. That was the way the game was for a very, very long time. And then one day it was like, you know, this game needs to be faster. It needs to be more of a meat grinder. We're, you know, the whole point of there not being line of sight, there not being a lot of defensive stuff in the game is because I really hate when you're like playing a hex-based game and you're like, okay, do I have line of sight on this? Well, I don't know. I need to get a ruler out, or I need to like, can this corner of this hex see that corner of that hex with no obstructions? Like, that stuff brings the gaming, the fun, to a halt for me. So I just, you know, I didn't want to have that kind of stuff in the game. And so that's where it was naturally leading, right? Like, how do we simplify this? How do we make things faster? And that's where it ended up. Yeah.
So along that same line, then, what are you the most proud of or excited about for this title?
It's got to be the story. The world that we've built is just incredible. And it's also because internally, you know, I went into this saying, hey, y'all, I've got a three game arc that I've kind of planned out in my head. And, you know, I explained the three games and the game types and where it was going to lead us. And then if we're doing the novel, the novels kind of accompany each of those games. And so it's a three novel story, right? And luckily everybody was like, well, let's see how this first one goes. Cause you know, you don't get a three book deal unless you're
sure.
Somebody with a name. And so, you know, I just really hope that people gravitate to the story, the narrative, and everything else, because that's what allows us, like when we have the support on the Kickstarter for the game, it's what's able, I can go next door to the film and TV department and say, look, we had 22,000 people who backed this game that are excited about it. And, you know, most of the time that like Rick and his team's pitching things to Amazon or pitching things to Netflix or whoever, you know, you're pitching them something that has zero base. So if you can go in and say, look at this. It has this huge following through Kickstarter and it's another product. They love that. And it's like a way to get you a step ahead of everybody else. So could Bloodstone be a Netflix series someday? Maybe. Could Tidal Blades? Maybe, you know. So that's why even when I say people are like, even if you don't think you want to buy the game through Kickstarter, even at a $1 pledge, you add your name to the list. You know, you help build out a bigger set of numbers that help us be able to do other things with the game.
Yeah, give you the position that you need in order to leverage and continue building and growing. It's the same thing with us when it comes to subscribers or people, you know, hitting the like button or leaving a comment. Mm-hmm. The sheer act of taking a moment to engage with a fan engage with a content creator, or engage with a publisher, or engage with something that you at least want to support and see in the space. That little addition makes a way bigger difference than you could imagine.
Yeah.
It's one of the things that we're doing. We have a big push over the next year to figure out and lend our voice in the platform that we have to establishing and getting more and more content creators to a point where, you know, publishers and their audience base is paying attention. And as a content creator, when you start and you're at 100 or 200 subscribers, you feel pretty good about it and you have a few core fan base. But it's nothing like crossing 1,000 or crossing 5,000 or 10,000, not only because your audience size grow, but also everything starts rewarding just that numbers game. Mm-hmm. YouTube starts sharing more. More people start watching. Publishers take you a little bit more seriously. Your fan base, when they show up, thinks that there's a community there to connect with. And so we're doing a hard push to find and identify content creators and channels that we think are good for this industry and not absorb them or anything like that. Instead, how do we just get our audience motivated to go encourage more people to have a voice in this space? It's how we grow as a community.
One of the things The Rock always says about his success is that he brings you with him. You know, it's not, what you said, it's not absorbing them. I want to bring you with me.
Give me 5 years in this space. It's a slow process. It always will be. But give me 5 years in this space. And my hope is that, you know, 5 out of the top 10 content creators, one of them is me. And then I hope 4 others are people that we have helped, you know, grow together and leverage each other's success and built each other up to a point where there's, and none of them are Quackalope. I don't need them to be. I don't want them to be.
Sure.
I want, you know, multiple people at the across the 100,000 mark in our industry, all of which have their own opinions and voices and are joining the conversation.
Yeah, man. I mean, one of the things that runs really parallel to that is when you zoom it out, like one of the things that I feel like is one of my core things is I'm a board game evangelist. And it's because I want to share with the world, the people who have not discovered board gaming, what I discovered that day I went and played, Power Grid. My brain just went dead. Power Grid with my friends. And, you know, the light went off. It was like, and now I have this thing that ties my family together. Like, we play board games several times a week. It's how I connect with my kids. It's a way that I connect with Sandra. It's how I connect with my friends. And Rodney said this in Starting Role. It was the first episode of Starting Role we did. Rodney Smith came in. And he says, there's just something magical that a board game does at the table. He's like, there's just this magic. He's like, you can't name it. You can't put words to it, but there's this magic that happens when you're playing board games with other people. We've all decided that this set of rules are going to govern us for this amount of time and that we're going to operate together in this way. And he's like, where else in the world does that ever happen? And I was just like, man, Rodney, A, you're a beautiful human. Thank you for that. You know, and two, you know, it's totally true. It's totally true. So, the thing I'm going to be most proud about, I can definitely like say, well, the dice mechanic, I think is really neat, where you're like, it's super unique, where you're putting your asymmetric dice as a spell into other people's hands and they have to roll it on their turn, which gets crazy results.
It's fun to roll more dice.
Right.
It just sucks when they're not helping.
That's right. But then, the other bit I would say is just that player experience. I really hope that people walk away from playing the game. Like almost like if you just finished a video game, right? And you're ready to go online. You're not always talking about the specific mechanic of the game. Is it a first-person shooter? Is it an RPG? Whatever. You're like, the experience, like I can't remember people talking about The Last of Us 2 and like the experience that gave them this last year, things like that. Like, that's what I hope and I feel like I'm going to be most proud about with Bloodstone once people have it and have run through the content.
I'm excited about it. I'm excited to not only play it again, but introduce it to more people and bring some content very soon to the channel. I believe when people are listening to this, your Kickstarter is already up. We were recording this about a week before everything goes live. And so as people are tuning in, how long is the campaign running?
It's 24 days. We typically run ours 24 days. So it'll be February 16th to March 12th is kind of awesome. Your timeline.
Awesome. And I believe this is also a Kickstarter exclusive title.
It is. And I know this is going to, you know, ruffle some feathers or get, you know, at least the eyebrows will raise for some people because we've never done this before. But this game is so expensive that it did not make sense to make a retail version. It doesn't work in the retail distro wholesale lane.
There is a type of game and a type of market that can only exist and only be justified through crowdfunding or you know, sites like that. I think we've seen it. I mean, I've seen it done with a lot of my favorite titles.
Sure.
A lot of the CMON titles, Kingdom Death, Madara, like Tainted Grail, all of the Awakened Realms stuff, all that stuff that would not be justifiable if you were putting it on a shelf and, right. and hoping that, you know, retail would be able to push it.
And that's, you know, that's one of the things I hope people realize that crowdfunding does, right? Even though they might look and say, well, Skybound's a big company. Why do they still use Kickstarter? Well, this product, though, would not even have a chance to exist. It would have been an automatic no if I said, hey, this game has a $125 price point. So let's make 5,000 copies and see how many we can sell through distro and see how it goes. It'd be a no because the risk is too high.
You have to prove that there's an audience there to the company that you work for. You have to prove that there's an audience there that is willing to say, yes, this is what I want.
So, you know, I'll still defend the CMONs of the world when people are like, they're too big to be on Kickstarter. It's not true. Because if you look at the product that they're giving you through crowdfunding, that product would not exist in the same way if they had to do a straight traditional wholesale retail chain launch. It just wouldn't
totally
look
agree.
The same. So
I totally agree.
You know, I get it that some people are jaded, and I know some people are hearing this and they're going, "Oh, you're just doing this for the FOMO. You're trying to cash it in," and it's just not true.
I think the grumpiest people and the most hurt people on the internet are the loudest. And it sucks that that's the reality of it, but I think it's true. And I feel bad for them. And I feel my heart goes out to them. I don't wish anyone ill. I try to live my life through the principle of like, don't be malicious.
Sure.
Never seek out or act with anger or vengeance or wish, harm to come to someone else. But the internet's a space where, you know, the loudest voice is the voice that's saying, how dare you, you know, money grabbing person try to do this. I think most of the community understands that, at least in my opinion, in my experience, most of the community understands that there's some things that just would not exist.
For sure. I'm excited about also that. Realize too, like, even though you might see a big number on a campaign, 2, 3, 4, 8 million, whatever, that doesn't always necessarily mean people are rich. And in fact, I would tell you, it doesn't mean anything about that, right? Like Isaac Childress did not become rich because Gloomhaven and Frosthaven had some big numbers. Like there's still only certain profit margins built into that. And I can tell they are small.
I have still seen Isaac Childress at conventions sitting in front of a table, talking to fans and selling his game.
For sure.
That alone means he's not rich.
Well, we're all rich in our own way, but
you know what I mean, though.
It's like I think people don't have a, and I didn't. So I know other people don't, because when I thought when Grim Forest hit $400,000, I was like, I'm rich. We've done it. We've
made $400,000.
And then like $400,000 is gone, because once you start paying for all the things to make the thing and you invest back into your company and, you know, you buy the retail stock that you need to sell for the next couple years. Like all that money's gone. And so and you're like, what do I live on? Hey, how do people make a paycheck making these projects?
one of the reasons why I have such a passion for and advocate for, the little indie designer and the person that's making a game that's selling 300 copies and why I want the channel as we grow to always make sure we have a door that's open to that type of content creator is both because I relate to the entrepreneurial spirit, and I think you do as well. Sure. From your own journey. I like people that are making things out of love and that are scrappy and fighting for something. But I also, before I got into the industry side of this space, never realized how scrappy this industry is, from the big CMONs of the world. Mm-hmm. and you know, all the way down to the person that's making a title that's getting, you know, even raises $20,000 on Kickstarter.
Yep.
You know, they probably didn't make anything off of it. And eventually they will.
Sure.
And I hope that we can build a bridge that allows them to. And as our industry swells and grows and continues, you know, transforming and inviting more people into the space, I think the trajectory of it is really exciting. But I love our space. I love our industry. Yeah. I love the games I get to play. I'm super excited about Bloodstone. And I can't wait to see a full finished production copy sitting on the table in front of me.
I can't wait for you to, now that you've taken on the first two bosses, I can't wait for you to see the next couple bosses.
Dude,
they're so good.
all right. I was a little disappointed that you didn't send me like seven more. The first two bosses are great. I really like the terror of the Underwood.
Everwood.
Yeah. Everwood. I just call it the Burbalist Bear.
We've nicknamed him internally the Terror Bear.
that's a good callback to the Board Game Spotlight.
Yeah. So I mean, you're gonna have things coming down the line that are still insect. You're gonna have some demony things. You're gonna have some Bane affected. Humanoid type things, and then there's a necromancer that you've got to deal with toward the end, and then you know the last boss. I've literally told no one about it. It's when we launch the campaign, that boss is going to be silhouetted. It's going to be blacked out. We're going to wait to the last 48 hours to unveil it. But I'll just tell you, Jesse. It's base. The base of this miniature takes up seven hexes of the arena. It's big. So good luck, team. Good luck. Yeah.
I hear what you're saying. Thank you, buddy. Thank you for joining us. If people want to connect with your community and want to check out your game, we've already established it's going to be on Kickstarter, but what's the best way for people to follow along with you and the community that you're sort of investing in?
So I'm always in the Board Game Spotlight on Facebook. Any of the Skybound Tabletop social media handles you can get to us at. We also have a Tabletop Insider newsletter. We don't do anything with other than once a month we send out updates on our games. So if you want to be in the know, you want to be like, we do discounts through that thing as well. So like, if you like going to our web store and buying stuff that at, you know, cool deals, I would say go sign up there. But yeah, I am easily found on the internet.
It's fair. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And anytime you need somebody to come nerd out about board games, you know, just bing.
We'll get
up.
You back on here.
Hit me up.
This latest failed attempt at bringing you quality entertainment was brought to you by the Quackalope Podcast. We love to hear from you, so don't forget to leave a review and subscribe. If you'd like to connect with us, follow us on any of our social channels or visit our website. But regardless of what you do, remember to do the important thing. Get out and play some games. Until next time.